Welcome to the deep dive. You asked for a deep dive into the muscular dystrophy chapter from Orthopedia, and we're here to deliver those essential insights. Think of this as your fast track to getting really informed on this pretty critical topic. We're going to talk about the muscular dystrophy chapter from the world's best, free, and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vaid. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
That's right. Our mission today is, well, it's to go beyond just the definitions. We want to really connect the dots.
Especially for Duchenne and Becker types.
Exactly. Especially as we unpack the complexities of Duchenne and Becker muscular dystrophies. This deep dive is about gaining a comprehensive understanding. We're pulling insights directly from that excellent source material so you can walk away with clear, actionable knowledge.
Okay, so our journey today kicks off right at the foundation. What is muscular dystrophy? They'll peel back the layers, look at the underlying biology, the genetics, which are fascinating.
Absolutely.
And then move into how it actually looks in a patient, how we diagnose it, and crucially, what we can do about it, management and treatment. Okay, let's begin. So, to start us off, when we talk about muscular dystrophy, it's not just one thing, is it?
No, not at all.
Our sources say it's actually a group over 30 different genetic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
What's the common thread?
Yeah, that's a really key point. While they all involve muscle degeneration, what's quite insightful is how incredibly varied they are. The unifying thing is the production of abnormal muscle proteins.
Yeah.
And that leads inevitably to progressive weakness and loss of muscle mass over time.
Okay.
But you see huge variation in severity, which muscles are hit first, the age it starts. It's really diverse.
And within that big group,
right,
the one that often comes up first, and probably rightly so because of its impact, is Duchenne muscular dystrophy,
yeah,
DMD. The sources really emphasize this one, noting it mainly affects boys.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it all comes down to one specific protein.
Mm.
You mentioned proteins. Let's talk about dystrophin. For us trying to really get a handle on the pathology, what exactly is dystrophin? Why is its presence or absence so critical here?
Dystrophin is absolutely central. You can't really understand DMD or Becker without understanding dystrophin. So in healthy skeletal muscle, it's a cytoplasmic protein. Think of it as a vital structural link.
Like a connector.
Exactly. It connects the internal scaffolding of the muscle fiber, the cytoskeleton, to the extracellular matrix, the stuff outside the cell membrane. And this connection isn't just about structure. It's critical for cell signaling, for keeping the muscle cell membrane stable, and really importantly, for transmitting the force from the contracting sarcomere, you know, the muscle's engine.
Right.
Transmitting that force effectively through the whole cell. Now, in Duchenne, that dystrophin is completely gone,
and
absent.
Completely, wow.
Yep. And in Becker muscular dystrophy, it's there, but either there's less of it or it's a sort of truncated, less effective version.
So if that critical link, that connector, is broken or faulty, what actually happens to the muscle tissue itself?
Well, that's where the damage comes in. Without functional dystrophin, the muscle cells undergo necrosis, they die, and you get subsequent fibrosis, scarring, essentially. So if you looked at the muscle grossly, you'd see healthy muscle tissue being gradually replaced by fibrous tissue and fat.
Ah, okay.
And microscopically, say on an immunoblot, you'd see zero dystrophin signal in DMD and a reduced or maybe altered signal in BMD. It's a fundamental breakdown of the muscle's integrity.
That connector analogy really makes sense. So if this is like a flaw in the body's instructions, how does this get passed down? What are the genetic roots?
Right. These are inherently genetic disorders. They can be inherited in different ways, autosomal dominant, autosomal recessive, or X-linked recessive. But for Duchenne specifically, it's an X-linked recessive point deletion. And this deletion causes what's called a nonsense mutation.
A nonsense mutation.
Yeah, it's like a critical typo in the gene that basically puts a premature stop signal. So the cell stops building the dystrophin protein way too early, meaning none gets properly made.
Okay, so it just halts production.
Exactly. Now, Becker is also X-linked recessive, but the mutation is often in a non-coding part of the gene, or it's a different kind of mutation. The key thing is it doesn't shift the whole reading frame. It doesn't scramble the entire genetic sentence like in DMD. So you still get some dystrophin produced, but it's often truncated, maybe smaller, less effective, and usually in reduced amounts.
That makes sense why Becker's is generally milder then.
Precisely.
And the sources mentioned the dystrophin gene itself is huge. Is that factor in?
Oh, absolutely. Its sheer size, almost 0.1% of the entire human genome, is a major factor.
Wow, 0.1%. That's massive for one gene.
It is. And think about it, the bigger the gene, the more DNA sequence there is, the more chances there are for a random mutation, a typo, to occur. It makes the dystrophin gene a bit of a genetic hotspot, which helps explain why DMD is, relatively speaking, one of the more common genetic disorders.
That's a great point. Makes the frequency make more sense. Okay, shifting gears a bit, let's talk about the clinical side. How does Duchenne usually show up in a patient? What are the signs you'd look for, especially early on?
Typically, DMD starts presenting between ages 3 and 6, and it usually hits the proximal muscles first, those closer to the center of the body.
Hips and shoulders mainly.
Hips and shoulders, exactly. So clinically, you'll see kids having trouble with things like jumping, running, maybe climbing stairs. Toe walking can also be an early sign. And then there's the calf pseudohypertrophy.
Pseudohypertrophy, meaning false enlargement.
Exactly. The calves look big, but it's not actually muscle. It's that fatty and fibrotic tissue infiltration we talked about replacing the muscle. You might also notice an increased lumbar lordosis, that inward curve in the lower back gets exaggerated as they try to compensate for weak gluteal muscles.
Okay. And beyond just watching how they move, there's a specific test, or rather a sign, that's often mentioned, right? Gower's sign. Can you walk us through that?
Ah, yes, Gower sign. It's quite characteristic and very telling. It describes how a child with this proximal weakness gets up from the floor. Instead of just standing up, they'll put their hands on the floor, then on their knees, and literally use their hands to walk up their legs.
Sort of pushing themselves upright.
Precisely. They're using their hands to push on their thighs to help extend their knees and straighten up. It clearly shows that weakness in the big muscles of the hips and thighs. They're relying on the relative strength they still have in their distal arm muscles to compensate. Sometimes they'll use furniture too, pulling themselves up.
That paints a very clear picture. So those are the early signs. But DMD is progressive. What does that journey look like as these children get older?
Yeah, unfortunately, the weakness is not only severe, but it relentlessly progresses. As they age, it spreads to the upper limbs, the trunk muscles, which often leads to significant scoliosis, curvature of the spine.
Okay.
Most kids with DMD will lose the ability to walk independently, usually becoming reliant on a wheelchair somewhere between, say, 10 and 15 years old. And eventually, this weakness affects the respiratory muscles. Breathing becomes difficult, leading to serious, often life-limiting respiratory problems. Cardiomyopathy, weakness of the heart muscle, is also very common.
So it really becomes a multi-system disease.
Absolutely. It starts in the skeletal muscle, but the downstream effects are widespread and profound. It really underscores how complex this condition is to manage long term.
It does. So we have the clinical picture, the Gower sign. What about objective proof? How do we confirm a diagnosis definitively? Lab tests, imaging.
The key lab test is measuring creatine phosphokinase, or CPK. It's an enzyme that leaks out of damaged muscle cells.
And in DMD.
In DMD, because there's so much ongoing muscle breakdown, the CPK levels can be astronomically high. We're talking up to 200 times the normal level. It's a huge indicator.
Wow, 200 times.
Yeah. Now, you can do a muscle biopsy, take a small sample of muscle tissue to examine it.
But.
But nowadays, genetic testing is much more common and often the preferred first step. It's less invasive. Using a technique like polymerase chain reaction or PCR, we can look directly for those characteristic deletions in the dystrophin gene. Finding that provides a definitive diagnosis.
Right, straight to the source code, essentially. We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit. What about the epidemiology? How common are these conditions? And that X-linked recessive pattern, what does that really mean in terms of who gets affected?
Right, so being X-linked recessive is key here. Males have one X and one Y chromosome. If they inherit the mutated gene on their single X chromosome, they will have the condition. They express the phenotype.
Because there's no second X to potentially mask it.
Exactly. Females have two X chromosomes. If they inherit one mutated copy, they're typically carriers. They usually don't show symptoms because their other X chromosome has a normal copy of the gene. Now, very occasionally, due to something called skewed X chromosome inactivation, a female carrier can show some symptoms, but it's much less common and often milder.
Okay, that clarifies the carrier aspect and the numbers. How often do we see DMD and BMD? Duchenne occurs in about 1 in 5,000 male live births. So while it's a rare disease overall, it's actually one of the more common genetic disorders.
And Becker.
Becker is less frequent, around 1 in 30,000 male live births.
Got it. Now, when a clinician sees a child with progressive weakness, maybe that Gower sign or the big calves, what else should be on their differential diagnosis list? What other conditions might look similar, and how do you tell them apart?
Oh, that's crucial. You definitely need to think broadly at first. Other types of muscular dystrophy, like limb girdle MD or myotonic dystrophy, could be possibilities. And beyond MDs, other progressive neuromuscular conditions need consideration. Spinal muscular atrophy, SMA, is a big one.
How do you differentiate SMA from DMD or BMD?
A key clinical sign is the deep tendon reflexes. In DMD and BMD, reflexes are usually preserved, at least early on. In SMA, they are typically absent or significantly reduced right from the start. That's a major clue.
Okay, reflexes are key.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Well, another condition that causes progressive weakness is Guillain-Barré syndrome. But the timeline is usually much faster, more acute. Plus, like SMA, Guillain-Barré typically presents with absent deep tendon reflexes. And importantly, the CKK levels in Guillain-Barré are usually normal, which is a stark contrast to the sky-high levels in DMD.
Right, that CPK difference is huge.
It is, so it really drives home the point. A really thorough neurological exam, paying close attention to those reflexes, is incredibly important in sorting through the possibilities when a child presents with weakness.
That makes perfect sense. So moving towards management, given that these are progressive conditions without a cure right now, what are the main treatment strategies? What are we trying to achieve? And what outcomes can patients expect?
Yeah, the focus really shifts to slowing down the progression and managing the symptoms to maximize quality of life and hopefully longevity. Corticosteroids like prednisone or deflazacort are a cornerstone of treatment for kids with progressive symptoms.
And they help how?
They've been clearly shown to slow the overall rate of muscle deterioration. This means they can help delay the loss of ambulation, preserve lung function for longer, and even reduce the severity or progression of scoliosis.
That sounds significant, but there are downsides.
Oh, definitely. The side effects of long-term steroid use are well known and can be quite challenging to manage. Things like significant weight gain, a Cushingoid appearance, that rounded face. For example, bone thinning leading to osteonecrosis, headaches, cataracts, GI issues, and stunted growth. It's a long list.
Yeah, that's a tough balancing act for families and clinicians.
It really is. It requires careful monitoring and managing those side effects alongside the benefits.
So given those trade-offs with steroids, what other kinds of support make a big difference? Supportive care must be huge.
Absolutely enormous. Respiratory support is critical as the disease progresses. Things like non-invasive ventilation, maybe using a ventilator just at night initially, have significantly extended lifespans for many patients.
Like CPAP or BiPAP machines.
Exactly. CPAP or BiPAP can work well for many. In more severe cases, a tracheostomy might eventually be needed for continuous ventilation. And physical therapy, along with orthotics, is just fundamental.
To keep them moving as long as possible.
Yes, and to maintain strength and range of motion in the joints, which helps prevent painful contractures where the joints get stuck in one position. Braces and orthoses can support mobility and function. And then, of course, when walking is no longer possible, adaptive equipment like customized motorized wheelchairs becomes essential for maintaining independence and participation in life.
It sounds like a very multidisciplinary approach is needed.
Totally. You need pulmonologists, cardiologists, neurologists, orthopedists, physical and occupational therapists, nutritionists. It takes a village.
And what about surgery? You mentioned orthopedics. Is there a role for surgical interventions in managing muscular dystrophy?
Yes, there is, although the exact role and timing, especially for some procedures, can be debated. For joint contractures like tight heel cords causing ankle plantar flexion or tight hamstrings leading to knee flexion contractures, surgical lengthening procedures can be done.
To help them walk longer.
That's the goal, yes, to prolong ambulation. But, and this is critical, the post-operative physical therapy has to be immediate and intensive. Otherwise, the time spent immobilized can lead to significant deconditioning, potentially negating the benefit of the surgery.
Right. Can't lose ground there. What about scoliosis?
Scoliosis is very common, especially once kids are primarily using wheelchairs. Importantly, bracing, like wearing a spinal brace, is not effective for neuromuscular scoliosis like this.
Really? Why not?
It doesn't actually stop the curve from getting worse, and it can significantly restrict their already compromised lung function, which is harmful.
Okay, so bracing is out. When is surgery indicated?
Surgery, usually a posterior spinal fusion, is typically considered when the curve reaches around 20 to 30 degrees. For very severe or stiff curves, sometimes an anterior release is done first. Often, the fusion needs to extend down to the pelvis to correct pelvic obliquity, which helps with sitting balance.
Other reasons for surgery?
Yeah, if the curve is progressing very rapidly, or if the patient has severe restrictive lung disease measured by things like forced vital capacity, that might also push towards surgery sooner. And the goals of the scoliosis surgery are really multifaceted. It's about stopping the curve, yes, but also preventing further decline in lung function and achieving a balanced spine over the pelvis for better sitting, comfort, and easier care.
That makes sense. Yep. A lot of factors to consider there. Okay, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground. To help consolidate everything, let's quickly recap five key terms that really emerged as central today.
Good idea. First, let's reinforce Duchenne muscular dystrophy. This is the most common and most severe form. Primarily affects boys, caused by that complete absence of dystrophin protein. It's X-linked recessive and typically shows up between ages 3 and 6.
Got it. Number two.
Becker muscular dystrophy. Also X-linked recessive, also mainly boys, but it's a milder form. Here, dystrophin is present, but it's either reduced in quantity or it's a truncated, less functional version. Onset is usually later, progression slower than DMD.
Okay, third.
Dystrophin itself, that crucial protein inside muscle cells. Remember, it's the link between the internal cytoskeleton and the outside extracellular matrix. Vital for signaling, membrane stability, and transmitting the force of contraction. Its absence or defect is the core problem in DMD and BMD.
Makes sense. Fourth term.
X-linked recessive, the mode of inheritance for both DMD and BMD, means the gene is on the X chromosome. Males are affected if they inherit the faulty gene. Females are typically carriers, though, as we mentioned, rare exceptions occur due to X inactivation patterns.
Right, and the last one.
Gower sign, that classic clinical sign. It's the maneuver where kids with proximal muscle weakness, like in DMD, use their hands to literally walk up their own legs to stand up from the floor. A clear visual indicator of that specific pattern of weakness.
Perfect. Yeah, getting a solid handle on those five terms really does crystallize the whole picture, doesn't it? They are definitely the cornerstones here.
They really are. And, you know, thinking about the discussion on surgery, particularly for contractures, that debate really highlights a delicate balance. You're weighing the potential benefit of prolonging function against the really demanding rehabilitation that's required afterward. It makes you consider not just what can be done surgically, but what's genuinely sustainable and truly beneficial for that individual patient's long-term quality of life. And that raises, I think, an important question for all of us.
Yeah.
How do we best empower patients and their families to make these really difficult, informed decisions when pretty much all the options come with significant trade-offs?
That is a powerful thought to end on. It really emphasizes the patient-centered nature of care, especially in chronic, complex conditions like this, and that constant need to balance interventions with overall well-being. It also reinforces why continuous learning and deeply understanding these nuances is so vital. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Binney, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.